All right, today is July 29th, 2015. I'm here with Kaya Rebina. This is the second interview of an oral history we're doing, which eventually we'll be talking about the Capitol protests in 2011, but we're getting there. So my first question today, well actually, Kaya, help me out here. Could you say your name and spell your last name?
Yeah, Kaya Rebina, and the last name spelled R-E-B-A-N-E.
Thank you. A little soft. Closer to you.
Do you want me to scoot in?
No, I think we're probably okay now. Okay. Somebody had the volume turned down,
mm-hmm.
which you can't really do for these smaller ones. All right, so we're going to talk about elections today, and I think we want to start with 2008, not necessarily the fall, but just your involvement in politics and elections starting in 2008. We'll go from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as I was just telling you right before we turned the recorder on, I mean, I knew that you were planning to ask about 2008 anyway, and 2010. And I think being involved in a lot of overlapping things makes things kind of run together a little bit in your mind. So I could remember bits and pieces, but I was having a little trouble figuring out what fit in which year.
Mm-hmm.
So I did like take a, not really long, but I quickly did a little search on the keyword election in my old emails and kind of
mm-hmm.
glanced at what was going on
mm-hmm.
throughout that period. So a lot of this stuff I kind of prepared a little bit in my head to remember what
okay.
actually happened there, because it all does become a bit of a blur after a while.
Okay, great.
So, although I mean, all the kind of details are all out of my head, pretty much. It's just that, okay, this was in 2008, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, well, I guess starting in the spring of 2008, so I've been involved, I think I mentioned in the last interview that I was involved in political activity with my union, with the TAA, since 2006. So that was ongoing. And so that means I was on the political education committee, and we did endorsements and other electoral type of work. So in spring 2008, I was on PEC. And that generally, you know, the individual elections, most of them, I don't remember the specific endorsement processes. Usually we would draft questionnaires, send those out, get responses from candidates. In some cases, we would interview candidates, although that was less common for the TAA than it is for some other organizations. And eventually make a recommendation of who we as the committee thought we should endorse to our general membership at a general membership meeting, and then the membership would vote and we'd end up with some kind of endorsement, and then we as PEC would follow up afterwards and disperse PAC money if desired, and have communications with the candidates and let them know that we had made an endorsement, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I was involved in all of that, certainly. Also, in spring 2008, I was still the TAA co-president. My co-president was Mark Supanich. So we were working together as the union leaders, and I was also on PEC, and so was Mark. So we both were doing that. That fall, one thing that does stick out of my mind, I remembered this even without looking at my email, was that we did kind of an interesting way of actually figuring out who to endorse for the presidential race, because more often than not, we would just take a vote or something at a meeting, but in this case, somebody, and it wasn't my idea, but I thought it was pretty cool, actually decided maybe it would be good to do a caucus, like Iowa style. I think it actually might have been Mike Quito that came up with that, but I might be wrong about that. That I know he was in the conversation. And it's okay to say names on this, I assume, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. yeah, so basically we had, as I recall, four corners of the room, I think, or however many candidates were still in the race. Edwards had just dropped out at that point, so we were down that one. That was at that point in the process. And we had people go to their corner and tried to convince others to come over to their corner, kind of thing. You know, and Obama ended up solidly with the nomination. We had a few Hillary supporters and what have you. But that was pretty cool, because I've never done that before. I mean, I've never lived in Iowa, so that was, I don't know, kind of fun. I also, since sometime in 2007, I think early 2007, was a delegate and still am a delegate to the South Central Federation of Labor, our local labor council here, SCFL. And so we also did candidate endorsements there. At the time, I was not on their Committee on Political Education, their COPE. Later on, I was. But at that time, I wasn't, so it was more a matter of just when the COPE would come up with their, well, they would do some preparation and invite candidates in for interviews, and then we'd go as the delegates and vote on who, you know, got endorsed. And
mm-hmm.
So definitely was participating in that. A lot of times the room would kind of divide a bit between, I say, the more conservative side, which was largely the building trades, and the more kind of progressive side, which was the teachers and the, you know, other kind of allied groups or whatever. So there was a lot of that kind of drama. But I think we all generally got along pretty well, although during endorsements, there was definitely some difference of opinion about who was best to endorse. So that was something that, you know, I can't say for that, like, I mean, generally, I would go for the endorsement meetings, so I assume I went in spring 2008. I'd be surprised if I didn't, although I don't actually remember that process, that particular season. And there were also, I mean, through the Dane Dems, the Democratic Party of Dane County, there were also endorsement membership meetings periodically, and I definitely went to some of those too, usually ones where I cared particularly about who, you know, got the endorsement, city council races and that kind of thing. So that's kind of like spring. There was other stuff also going on in spring 2008, and there was just a lot. I was feeling kind of overwhelmed when I was looking back kind of through my email trying to figure out what actually was going on that semester. So, I mean, the TA, we were bargaining with the state, and that was sort of this long ongoing thing. We were trying to get our 2007 to 2009 contract bargained, and we didn't actually get it bargained until, like, after it basically was, or at least ratified. I mean, it was this long thing where we were pretty much bargaining for a couple of years back for a while because we didn't actually get it done until, I think, sometime in 2009, I'm not sure. I mean, I was a steward for my department, technically. I organized, like, a polar plunge team for the Special Olympics polar plunge for the TAA. I was co-running our weekly TAA happy hour with the GSC, which is the Graduate Student Collaborative, with a friend of mine, Jeff Isle, and running this constitution committee where we were trying to figure out changes to the TAA constitution. So it was kind of this constellation, and, of course, as co-president, I mean, Mark and I would divide up which committee meetings we would go to, and there were a few, like PEC, where we would both be there, but there were others where it's like, okay, you get this one, and I'll get this one, and so it was meetings pretty much just about every day of the week, if not, you know, during weekdays, sometimes a couple of them, and I got really sick of glass nickel pizza that particular time, that particular year, because I was eating it almost, I felt like, every day, because that was usually the standard go-to thing for meetings. And we actually had money at that point, because Act 10 hadn't happened yet. We had, you know, budget lines for the different committees, and it seemed like people liked pizza. So I ate an awful lot of glass nickel pizza. I still don't have a taste for this stuff, honestly. But, so there was just a lot of activity with all of that. And, there was also still, I mentioned last interview, at the time, Coalition for Affordable Public Education group that I had with some other people kind of co-founded after it was a TA committee. That's where it originated. And so that was ongoing too. I don't think I was actually co-chair of it by that point. I was one of the first two co-chairs, and I think by this point I was no longer, but I was definitely actively involved with that. Meet every week and discuss university politics and how to make things better and try to come up with innovative ways of fixing problems, basically. This was also, during that year, there was also a group meeting, which had been meeting since also, I think, early 2007, that Don Nelson, the chancellor's, or the university lobbyist at the time, put together, called the Legislative Strategy Group, which was basically all of those of us with campus organizations, well, I don't know if all, but at least a good number of us, that represented different campus organizations that were doing legislative kind of work up at the Capitol. And the idea was to come together and try to see if there were synergies and just talk to each other. We didn't coordinate our lobbying activities beyond that, but we basically just kind of would talk and figure out if there were things that were in common interest and what have you. So I was there as a representative of the TAA for the beginning of it, and then after a while I ended up being the representative of CAPE, I believe. But that went on for a good number of years. So we had people from obviously the chancellor's office and people from profs, which is the lobbying arm of the faculty senate, and people from ASPRO, which is the equivalent organization for the academic staff assembly, and people from some of the other unions as well, and so we'd all get together and talk. I also, for briefly, was a part of Daryl Bazell, who's the was the vice chancellor for what, administration, I want to say? Anyway, in the chancellor's office. He put together a labor management advisory committee, LMAC, that was also was basically meetings with the university leadership and various labor representatives. And so I was in that for a little while, although I don't think that was a very long commitment on my part. I think somebody else, maybe it was Mark Sipanich, I'm not sure. Somebody else stepped in after a while, I think. But that was a brief thing around the same time, although I'm not sure exactly the date there. You want me to keep going on this like long list of, because I'm only like halfway through this. Like.
that is fine.
We also had some budget stuff, like lobbying stuff, if you want to hear about that.
So. Yeah, I would like to hear about that.
Okay.
But I think you're right, and this may be more of a comment than a question. It's amazing that you're sort of doing all stuff at the same time, you know, in the spring of 2008. So you said there was some budgeting stuff.
Yeah, so there was, I was also at that time on something that the chancellor's office also pulled together, and this is more, I think Bazell was more, I believe, behind pulling this together, although now I'm struggling to remember, but called the Graduate Funding Committee, where this actually came out of the work that CAPE had been doing on trying to increase funding for graduate education and where it overlapped with what the chancellor's office was trying to do, which was get more funding in general and obviously support, among other things, graduate education. And so we ended up meeting and coming up with some ideas for increasing, through a request for additional funding from the state, a way to leverage other funds to increase the resources available to support graduate assistants in a couple of ways. And technically I actually wrote the first draft of this, but it got revised by the committee of a $5.25 million funding request to go into the 2009 to 2011 biennial budget. And so that ended up being included in the Regents' budget proposal to the state. Now, it didn't actually end up getting passed at the end, but it got in there, which at least I think those of us in CAPE, because there were a number of us in CAPE that were on that committee, we felt pretty good about at least getting it that far. And obviously we did lobbying around that too, once it was out there with the Regents especially. And actually we did some meetings with the Regents as well around it to educate them about why this is important and why we, you know, mm-hmm. should focus on this and include this. That was also the semester when the search and screen process for our two chancellors ago, I guess, because we had an interim, Biddy Martin. So she ended up getting hired, but there was a shared governance search and screen process to do that, as there is for these kinds of offices. And I was not on the search and screen committee. I did apply to be on it, but I wasn't selected to be on it. But I did get asked to come to, there was a series of candidate luncheons before the final decision was made, because the way the process works is the committee will come together and identify candidates, interview them, vet them, and decide on a short list, which has to be of a specified length generally, like a certain number of people. Mm-hmm. And then the whoever is kind of immediately above that person's office in the hierarchy is going to actually make the decision. So in this case, the Regents made the decision about who to hire, but they have to pick out of that short list. So that's how it kind of balances the interests of the faculty, staff, and students against the administration. So for the chancellor, these luncheons were at the university club, and there were four of them. There were four final candidates. It was Rebecca Blank, actually, our current chancellor, was one of those candidates. And so I ended up in there as one of the ASM student reps, or maybe the only one, I'm not sure. So I ended up in all of those, and there were a couple of other people I knew who also ended up in one or the other, like Mark Sipanich was in one, I think, and my friend Bill Tracy was, I think, in one. And anyway, and so as the candidates were talking, we were all asking questions, and I was taking notes furiously, which didn't seem to bother any of them, which was nice. and afterwards, in consultation with these other folks that had been in there, I drafted an email to the TA's membership, because again, I was TA co-president at the time, on the candidates' responses, because who the chancellor is incredibly important for the TA and graduate students in general. And so I felt like my role there was to get the best idea I could of the candidates' responses on things that we might not know otherwise. And I specifically was asking about collective bargaining for academic staff and faculty, since that was an issue at the time that we'd been, a number of us had been kind of pushing for and organizing towards and what have you, although I was asking other questions as well. And so anyway, I drafted basically this email up and ran it by the other two, and then Mark and I sent it out, and it got circulated really widely. And it ended up also getting sent on to the Regents, I think, by our AFT Wisconsin president, I believe. And I remember Blank responded to it, because, I mean, the email essentially said, I mean, from my impression at the time, was Biddy Martin was the one that really answered all the questions the way that, you know, he'd hoped to have her answer them. And so she seemed like a really clear choice. Now, I changed some of my personal views on her I guess, qualifications for the job later, but that was the nature of that. So anyway, so that was like kind of one more thing that was going on that semester. And then I think the Natatorium Segfi issue arose sometime around that time. I know that the first I'd heard about that was from some of the folks I knew in faculty governance that had mentioned, or I think one person who had mentioned that that the recreation folks had come and proposed that in some meeting they were in to go ahead and just raise seg fees for this, kind of on the model of the Union South thing a few years before. And my recollection is that it was presented more or less as this is the first choice of how we should do it, as opposed to let's go and try to find other sources and this might be a backup, which of course made me pretty mad, because I felt like and it made him mad as well, I think, felt like it was this idea that we could just use the students as sort of a piggy bank for these capital projects through these seg fees, which in my opinion anyway shouldn't be used for that kind of thing. That's something that should come through other revenue sources, because seg fees are supposed to be there to serve student needs. I mean, the Natatorium is a student thing, however it's also used by other groups on campus, and it's a big capital project where you can't really have, it's not like the students this year can really decide that, oh, if we vote to go ahead and say, okay, it's okay with us to pay a whole lot more in seg fees, that's going to be with students going into the future. So you're basically being asked to vote on whether to tax not only yourself, and probably not yourself. I think actually there was going to be some kind of a lag, and that was the proposal that eventually came up, where a few years you didn't have students actually paying, and then it kind of kicked in after the current crop of students had graduated, more or less. Mm-hmm. But you're basically voting on whether to tax future generations of students, so to speak. So anyway, but that arose around that same time too, and I started kind of trying to poke into that. Then there was also, 2008, so that spring, there was some Obama stuff that started coming together. The first thing I think I was involved in the Obama campaign at all was that April in 2008. There's a woman who, I think she was maybe working as a staffer, I'm not sure if she was actually, she worked for Corey Mason in the legislature for a while, but Vicky Selko. And she pulled together a little group to organize an event of some kind. And I don't even remember what the event was, but there was a little organizing group that she pulled together to kind of organize this event for Obama. And so that was my first, I think, actual organizing on that campaign, although I don't think I did a ton on there. I went to some meetings and helped with some planning. That spring there was also, so I think I mentioned at the last interview that there was one year where I was co-chair of the Alliance for Graduate Employee Locals, which is the national kind of organization under AFT of all the graduate employee unions in AFT. And so I was elected co-chair that spring. So I served from spring 2008 to spring 2009 in that capacity. So that's through summer. And then summer that had some other stuff, like there was the first AFT National Convention that I ever went to in Chicago, so that was definitely a learning experience. I don't know if you actually want to hear much about that, but that was a learning experience in various ways. And then you get into fall, so I'm going to just stop and see whether you want me to keep rambling, or if you want me to
There's a couple of things I want to ask about the spring.
Yeah.
And then I am interested in the AFT National Convention, because again, it talks about sort of your progression or continued involvement in things. First is spring of 2008. I mean, you know, you just spoke there for nearly 20 minutes about what you're involved in the spring.
Oh my goodness.
And so I assume you're still either.
I didn't even give you any details about most of that stuff.
You were being a TA or.
Yeah, what was I doing in spring? So that's what I'm trying to. I actually didn't go back and look at that. I'm sure I could dig it up and figure out which appointment I actually had that semester. But yes, I did have a an appointment of some kind. I'm actually looking because I bet I could pull up a resume or something I've got it written on here somewhere. But yes, I was working in some way. The thing is, I've been employed all over the university in various different divisions and various different capacities. And so, it gets to be one of those things where I'll remember the appointment, but I don't necessarily remember the year until I go back and check. So let me see. So 2008, I got my resume up here now. I can figure out where I even put this down. Okay, so at that point I was working as a teaching assistant in the business school for a course called People, Planet, Profit, which was actually, I was funded through the Nelson Institute, as I recall, and I was kind of on loan as a teaching assistant because I had been working in the director's office. So yeah, that's what I was doing in spring 2008, according to this anyway, which should be correct.
And are you taking classes in 2008? Okay.
Yeah, I was. I couldn't tell you exactly what. I think I was doing I was doing a bunch of stuff over in agriculture and applied economics around that time because I had added a master's program to my original master's. So I had the one master's program and then I added a second master's program in ag econ. And I was, I believe, still working on the requirements for getting that done certainly then. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is being a TA allowing you to pay the bills, so to speak, or are you having to find additional ways to help pay the bills too?
I'm not sure that specific semester. For the most part, yes, but there were definitely times that I ended up taking loans too, because I think that was more when I was, I have accumulated a decent number of loans during graduate school. Definitely when I was working as a project assistant, there was I'm not sure if that was when I was in the director's office that I was a 33% PA. I'm not positive, but I think so. But there was a period where I was a 33% PA and I was bringing home a little over $8,000 a year. And so that just wasn't enough my rent plus food basically ate up all of that. So I definitely was taking loans then. And then I had some, you know, other additional things like field work that ran over budget and that sort of thing earlier on. So I definitely was taking loans during a lot of these years, and I wouldn't be surprised if I took one that semester, but I honestly don't quite remember at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I do remember conversations with other graduate students through the TAA. I remember one that I was sitting out at a bar or something, and somebody who was an RA over in the biological sciences or medical kind of biological sciences was talking about how he brought home like 20-something thousand dollars a year, and I was just like blown away because that was so much more than I was having, and I was kind of, you know, trying to not spend too much as I usually would because just didn't want to, you know, take out more loans than I needed to basically. But just the range of different compensation levels and how much work people would have to do for that thing definitely was pretty striking, because there were a good number of of appointments that were relatively low paying, say things like teaching sections of languages like over in Spanish or whatever, where you would end up with a relatively low appointment level. Routinely people would go over their hours, and this was a contract enforcement issue, this is one reason I remember this, and end up with other problems. And then you'd have RAs or sometimes like PAs in places like the business school where they just wouldn't even seem to be asked to do the full, well, they would be expected to do the work, but then a lot of times they could wrap up their responsibilities in less time rather than more. So it definitely was variable in terms of where you were and kind of what your role was seen to be. And with research assistants, they would usually finish a lot faster as well, because there's a lot of reasons for that, but I think one is that you're working on something generally that's related to your own research and your own dissertation topic, and so as you're working, you're also making progress towards your dissertation. While a lot of times when you're a TA, well, TA, sometimes you're building teaching experience, it might help you on the job market, but a lot of times you're teaching things that may or may not be helping you directly towards your degree goals. And for divisions that more use TAs and not so much RAs, like the humanities and the social sciences and all that, you do see longer times to completion. And project assistants as well, because there you're doing kind of, that's a grab bag of everything that isn't being an RA and isn't being a TA. Basically, a lot of times you're working on somebody else's research that's not helping you directly towards your degree, or you're doing administrative work or whatever it is. And so that oftentimes also, I mean, I was technically an RA at one point when I was really a TA, but I was a CALS TA, so I was technically an RA, but my responsibilities were as a TA. That was like 2005 when I was TAing for renewable energy technology. I think I mentioned that last time. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. This isn't necessarily specifically about spring 2008, but maybe just in general. You know, you're a TA, you're taking classes, you're matriculating towards a degree or degrees in your case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was in three programs by that point. We are kind of half quasi in one, but definitely in two.
But are you seeing at the time, or maybe upon reflection, about how the work you're doing, the political work or the social activism you're doing, is actually an education sort of in and of itself?
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, I think at this university I've at least... I mean, I thought about this before. If I were to be able to go back and choose again where to go to grad school, you know, what might I do differently? And honestly, in terms of the program, I feel like I could have made a better choice where I could have, well, there are things I would have done differently to increase my chances of getting funding more easily, so I wasn't always looking for it. Having more of a structured kind of program with more concrete milestones and more of a support network and all that kind of stuff. Even though it's nice to have the freedom to do things that the Nelson Institute gives you. But on the other hand, coming to Madison, I've just been involved in a lot of things. There's a lot of really good people here and a lot of activism. And I've been involved in a lot of stuff that I probably wouldn't have been if I'd gone other places, or at least not in the same way. And so I've now forgotten what you asked. I'm running low on sleep right now.
Of your activism is education. So, I mean, you're not going to get a degree for it, but...
Right. Yeah, I'm not going to get a degree for it, probably. Although, honestly, like, my current dissertation work comes out mostly of what I've done activist-wise. Like, that's how I ended up in my current topic. So, it's all interrelated. And you learn things that you can apply in places you don't expect, which I think is one argument against this idea that the role of a public university should just be job preparation, that you get trained for a specific trade or a specific job. I think that that's one role of public education, but definitely far from the only one, because a lot of times that exploring and being involved in different things, both within coursework and within the academic curriculum, and also in extracurricular stuff, whatever that is, ends up being just as important to, you know, your ability to do whatever you want to do later, whether it's affect political change or it's to make some, you know, scientific discovery or whatever to help humanity or just have a good life for yourself later. There's just so many factors that you can't predict that go into that kind of thing. So yeah, definitely. I mean, all this stuff is educational, I feel like. Yeah.
So, thank you for that. And now I am interested in that summer. You said you went to the AFT National Convention in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Part of me just interested because it's sort of 40 years from the Democratic Chicago Convention in 1968. And I'm assuming the two things, not that you were at the one in 68. But
I was not.
I'm assuming the two things were probably quite different. But anyway, at least in terms of your memories of the summer of 2008 at the AFT, let's start there, and then maybe that'll get us to the fall.
Okay, sure. Yeah, and I think that part of why I think that the summer convention is interesting is because I ended up going to subsequent national conventions in 2010 and 2012 as well, and then was involved in the one in 2014 in a way from afar. So a lot of graduate employees are more transitory than I am, I would say, in terms of being a graduate employee. And so it's very common for the grad unionists to come to these conventions and kind of have no idea what's going on, because there is this culture and this structure and this process that you have to know what you're doing to actually get stuff done. And a lot of the other delegates have been there many times before, and their locals know what's going on, and they just know how to play the game, I guess. And the grad unionists generally didn't. And that was my first convention, and I certainly was surprised. I mean, it's really big, number one. And there's certain internal dynamics with AFT where you've got one very large local in New York that has enough voting power to basically outvote just about everybody else unless everybody else votes the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a lot of power. So there's some political dynamics there. And then just in terms of how the whole process functions, there's these committees that you have to get on ahead of time by indicating on your registration materials which one you want to be on, and you can change that when you get there too. But there's these committees that take resolutions. So there's a lot of what goes on is voting on resolutions, although there's a lot of speechifying and other stuff that happens. And so if you want to pass a resolution to state that the official position of AFT National is X, it has to go through a committee generally, at least that's the typical process, has to go through a committee, and then the committee gets a chance at modifying it and recommending it for adoption or rejection and ranking it in terms of how high up they think it is in the total number of things that they've been handed, that's been given to their committee. And only the top, what is it, the top three? I forget, but it's the top handful of things from each committee get to the floor generally. Theoretically, you can get to the other ones later, but that's only if you have enough time, and that never happens in my experience. The session always runs long, and you just don't, and the rest of that gets shunted off to the executive committee to deal with later, I think. So anyway, but that first convention, there was a new delegates orientation at the beginning, which I'm pretty sure I skipped because I didn't really know I should go, and I'm not sure how useful it would have been anyway. I never did go to one of those things. But the committee process, I just remember being kind of baffled by the whole thing. And once things got to the floor, trying to speak on different resolutions or different things that people were trying to pass. And they have a rotating microphone system as well, where you'll have the mics that are labeled like 1, 2, 3, etc. And every time another resolution comes up, you'll start at wherever the next mic was after the last one, the last conversation left off. And the UFT, that's the local two people, have enough people there that they can cover pretty much every mic and jump into line immediately. And they were very effective at when they have decided they don't want something to pass to just shut down discussion by calling the question or whatever. And so it was very frustrating because trying to figure out where you had to be to jump in there, but you can't be hovering near the mic. You have to be like sitting down. And there's just all these kinds of things that I didn't really realize before that. And then later on, and this is jumping ahead a bit, but like the 2010 convention in Seattle, that time I definitely got the hang of it more. It was my second time around. And after that one, I actually started drafting a document that I was planning to share through Agile, for basically a, here's a convention primer, essentially. Here's how the whole process works. Here's where you have to be to affect change in these different ways. Here's what to look for. You know, here's how things kind of go. And so I was working on that, and I remember having, it never really got to the point of disseminating, in part because there were some concerns about, well, you know, the grad union folks, if like our rep from AFT National, I think had some concerns about, well, this may not go over well with the executive committee, that, you know, the Agile funding for conferences or something might end up, like, he just wasn't sure if it was a good idea to be circulating that openly. So he basically, I think, said, well, you can share it amongst yourselves, but don't do it openly, kind of thing, which makes it really hard for institutional memory purposes, which is basically what I was trying to do, because I'd been involved in trying to increase institutional memory in the TAA as well, and trying to do things that would help us remember, you know, the lessons we learned a few years before, because there's just so much turnover, it's hard to remember stuff. And that was essentially what I was trying to do there. But it didn't end up really going anywhere, although I've got somewhere on my computer probably like this primer of, here's how the committee system works. Here's when you have to actually ask to be on a committee. Here are the committees that usually, you know, work on stuff that we care about, you know, those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was an interesting experience. And then, let's see, 2012 was, that was in Detroit. I also went to that one. That was after Act 10 already, so our funding had been quite a bit cut. So I went with I think he was co-president of the union at that point, just the two of us. And I tried to get through at least one resolution and had that totally not make it through at all. It was actually a move to like a constitutional amendment to say the corporation's not people, money's not speech thing. And I think that my interactions with the executive committee and UFT people basically showed they didn't really understand it and didn't want to have it passed because they didn't understand. And I tried to do some outreach before, but I hadn't had time to do it properly. Anyway, so that didn't work out that time, and that was frustrating in different ways. But then finally, 2014, my delegate status ended up getting mixed up. And so I was actually going to be the only person to go to a convention in Los Angeles, I believe it was. And then my delegate status, somehow or other, the paperwork got shuffled, or I don't know, but I didn't end up having delegate status. So I was like, well, the main reason I was going was I wanted to take another stab at that resolution. And I also had a Keystone XL related resolution, but the Mutchamend one was probably the main one that I thought had a chance. And I didn't end up going because I decided at the last minute, at that point I was going to pay for the airfare myself. There wasn't really a budget line anymore for that. And I decided at the last minute that I was going to cancel the trip because I didn't have delegate status and I just didn't feel like it was worth the $400-something or whatever it was to fly out there. But then I did talk with some folks who helped, you know, speak in favor of that. And I think that the UFT people, and I actually worked with some folks in New York as well, ahead of time to try to contact the UFT people in New York to kind of get this on their radar screen. I don't think that was that successful, but our Move to Mend people in New York have been doing a lot of good work, and people nationally have been doing a lot of good work, and the whole constitutional amendment thing has been a lot more in the media than it was at the time of the last convention, the 2012 convention. And so I think that, I mean, the UFT people came out and they basically came out in support of this thing, and of course it sailed right through then with basically more or less unanimous support, I think. And so that did pass, and so now we actually do have AFT on record as, you know, in favor of a constitutional amendment. But it was this ongoing process over time of getting that through, and I definitely have learned a lot about how those things work. I mean, the AFT convention is a really interesting time to meet people from elsewhere, and I mean, I've gotten to know some of the folks often, well, in part of actually, part of UFT in New York, in the Professional Staff Congress, which is the CUNY, I think it's the CUNY faculty. Anyway, but a lot of kind of more, I guess, radical folks or whatever, and so ended up involved in, to some degree, in their alternate, there's also a caucus system, that's the other thing. They've got this little Peace and Justice caucus that tends to be the more progressive one, and then there's something called the Progressive Caucus, which is kind of the, to some degree, the status quo people that have the power of caucus. So that's the big caucus that almost everybody, except for the these other folks go to, and anyway, and so if you want to actually get stuff done through the, you know, if you want to work with the people who represent the folks who have more voting power, then that's the caucus you probably want to be involved in and all that. So there's also that sort of stuff that when you show up the first time, you have no idea how caucuses work, you don't know about committees, you don't know how the thing's structured, you're not really sure about any of that stuff, and it just takes some time to kind of learn. Mm-hmm. So.
Thank you for that. That seems to sort of take the AFT stuff through, at least in an overview, through to the present. So is there anything that you want, anything more you want to talk about? Well, I guess we want to talk about the fall of 2008.
Maybe that's a good place to, I don't know how long you want to, this interview today, maybe.
Yeah, let's
end there today.
Let's do fall 2008 and see where that takes us in terms of time.
Okay, that sounds good. Okay, so in fall, one thing that, I mean, the CAPE group was working fairly intensively still on this, on trying to get some different reforms. The main one, I think, at the time was we were trying to get resident tuition for non-resident graduate students after the first couple of years on the basis of that people will come here, they'll pay taxes, they'll maybe send their kids to school, public school here, they'll be part of the community, etc. But unless you actually take off a whole year and work full-time here, you can't claim resident tuition ever. And that can be a disincentive for recruitment potentially, and obviously it can create a hardship for students who do come here, because by the time you've been here a few years, you are a resident in every way except for by law, right, for tuition purposes. So, and this would also have helped the structural deficit that's based on tuition remissions that the university was dealing with this kind of lack of congruency between the way that the state counted tuition remissions and the actual practice of how the university granted tuition remissions. And this opened up this structural hole, basically. So this would help address that to some degree. So we were working on that with the folks in the chancellor's office and trying to move that forward. So we were already working on that. That was an ongoing thing that was going on further than fall 2008, though I think that was just starting at that point to kind of coalesce in that particular direction. Within the TAA, I was also we were in the process of, we had a staff union, which I think that fall we had, we had three staffers, so they had their own union, and so we were in the process of bargaining with them, and I was in the bargaining team. And I don't really want to talk too much about that, because that there was a lot of complication in that particular process, but that was one thing that was taking a lot of time at the time. I also helped found a group, a student organization called Wisconsin Student Lobby. I wouldn't say I was super central for that. That was a fellow, what's his name? His last name's Wright, Jeff Wright, who was involved in ASM and then graduated, and I don't know what he's doing now, but this was kind of his brainchild. And the idea was to train students to actually be able to go up to the Capitol and talk to, legislators about interests that students have. So citizen lobbying, obviously, not like paid lobbying or anything. And since I had lobbying experience with CAPE and with AFT a bit, I think, as well, well, the TAA anyway, he kind of asked me to help with this, among other people. And so we ended up getting funding for staff, and so I was involved in interviewing, staff, for, students, basically, for staff, a good number of staff positions for this new group, and helping kick off the organization. And then I was involved in going to meetings for, a while anyway, maybe for the next, year or at least several months. So that took some time as well. And I worked on coming up with a name. That's not really important, but obviously I was still on PEC. Then there was also the midterm election. This is 2008, the presidential election. So obviously that was the first Obama election. And I don't remember all of the details. I'm sure I was probably out canvassing and phone banking and doing that kind of stuff to some degree, just because I basically always do that kind of stuff. So I don't remember specifically what it was I was doing, but I think that I was definitely doing some of that. For the election itself, I went with my best friend Bill, another friend Greg, who I'd actually recruited onto our TA PEC a while before, and so we'd become friends across political interests and such. Anyway, we all signed up to do election protection work in Milwaukee for that election. So we did a training and then ended up going to Milwaukee, and Bill ended up in some suburban polling place, I think, where it was really boring, he said, where he was just mostly sitting there and watching nothing happen the whole day. But Greg and I ended up in an urban low-income polling place. Well, it was a polling place that involved multiple different wards. It was set up in, I think it was a school. I believe it was a school. And it was kind of just chaos. Enormous lines, mostly African-American population, enormous lines just stretching out and, for these long distances, and confusion about who was in which ward and people getting in the wrong line. And then, there was a accessible entrance in the back with a ramp that had to have somebody unlock it, so you'd have people come up and want to use it, but there wasn't anybody there to unlock it, and the bell, I think, or whatever, the thing didn't, I forget if it didn't work, or so. And there were, so basically the people that were running the place were just running around trying to maintain chaos, limit the chaos as much as possible, I felt like what it was. And there were just other problems, things were breaking, and I don't know. So anyway, pretty early on, both Greg and I ended up ditching our election protection garb, because we had t-shirts on that said election protection or something, and just jumping in and helping with the logistics and trying to keep, things, helping out with whatever people needed help with. And then at times also trying to keep people who were in line from leaving, because, a lot of people had come on their lunch break or whatever it was, and they were having to wait for hours and hours. And so a lot of people were having to leave or were not, didn't know how much longer it was going to be. And so part of it was also going and saying, hey, are you guys doing okay? And, do you need anything? Not that we had a lot to offer necessarily. There was one woman I remember who, I think it was her first time she'd voted or tried to vote anyway. And she came in and realized she was at the wrong polling place entirely after waiting in the line for, I believe, a while. And I ended up, for that particular person, I remember I ended up calling Bill, because he was, hey, are you still, doing nothing up there or whatever? What are you doing? And so he came down. He had the car, so he came down and gave her a ride, I think, to her correct polling place. And I forget. I don't know. I remember him having some comments about that, but I don't remember what they were at this point. But it was just, this huge mess, right? And so our plan actually had been to go do election protection work for the day and then drive down to Chicago, since we were already in Milwaukee, to go and hear Obama's speech. And we totally did not make that because we were there well after the polling places closed, trying to still help out with the things that were still going on. People were still trying to vote, you know, just, you know, so we were there relatively late, or at least late enough that we couldn't get to Chicago. I don't think we stayed till everything was wrapped up there, but we stayed certainly after eight. And so it was like driving back from Milwaukee to Madison that we were listening to the radio about, you know, this state, okay, this state's gone for Obama and this state's gone for Obama. And we went through a dead zone where there wasn't any radio, you know, like between the two cities. And going into the dead zone, we were thinking, okay, well, if we just, if this one flips and this one flips, it sounds like he might, you know, looks like he very well might win, but we didn't really know yet. And then we came out of the dead zone and the news was like, you know, he just won the election by quite a lot. And so that was really like emotional, I think, for us and for, just like it was for a lot of people. Well, probably shouldn't say just like, but it was emotional for us for sure. And, you know, with people at that point in, I know Madison and other places were like out running down State Street and whatever. And we went back and went to the Monona Terrace, I think, for the Democratic, you know, kind of celebration or whatever, which was a, it was nice because one of the last times, I'm not sure if I was there for 2006, I don't think so, but in 2004 it was really depressing because that was that election where Kerry and Bush, and it was just like one state flipped red after another, and I was in a union hall over by the Oscar Mayer plant that particular election. I'd been doing like training for, I'd been training people on the day of to go out and, you know, do canvassing and what have you with the League of Conservation Voters. And that day, I just remember sitting in that union hall and being so depressed as we were watching one state flip after another, and it's just like something didn't smell right, and we were all just suspicious and really upset and tired and grumpy. And then we decided we would go down to the Monona Terrace because maybe at least that would be a better atmosphere than all sitting in this basement like this union hall. And that was like even worse. Everybody's like totally depressed. So anyway, like 2008 was a complete contrast. Of course, people were like, you know, raising their glasses and just, you know, this kind of, even though we got there relatively late, there were still people hanging around and just really happy. And that was nice. You know, and the, definitely it felt very, even though I definitely wasn't, I mean, I've always had some concerns about Obama, primarily with his foreign kind of policy orientation. I mean, the importance of electing an African-American president was absolutely, I mean, there's no way to underestimate that. That was huge. So, and I mean, he seemed like a pretty good guy otherwise in most ways. So, you know, I was pretty happy about that. So I think that's most of what I got for that semester. I mean, yeah, after that it goes into 2009 on my little cheat sheet that I made. So.
All right, so I think we're probably, I don't have a watch on, but I'm guessing we're close to
9:54 according to my...
I don't know if there's, I don't know what you think in terms of your 2009 stuff, if you have time to talk about that. I have at least, you know, 5, maybe 10 minutes.
Okay, I can, yeah, there's a lot less that went, at least a lot less that I kind of noted. And like I said, I just took a quick skim through my email just because I was having trouble remembering dates, so I'm not trying to exhaustively enumerate every single thing out. I was doing during those years. There was a lot of little stuff that was also in the mix. Let's see, so in the spring of 2009, we were busy lobbying on that, oh gosh, it's called a DIN, and I don't remember now why. So it's a graduate education DIN that came out of this committee where we wrote that budget request that I mentioned before. That, and this wasn't by then included in the region's budget proposal, and we were trying to convince the Joint Finance Committee to, you know, put it into the their draft budget, I think. DIN, what does that mean? It's a decision item narrative, is that right? Something like that. But it's basically a budget request. I mean, I remember being that spring at, there was a Joint Finance Committee hearing in Cambridge, and we went and testified there. And I don't remember, I don't think that was the first JFC hearing I ever went to. I think there have been others before and since, so that's something that was sort of just standard at budget time that I feel like this is what you do kind of thing. I'm pretty sure that wasn't the first, but I don't remember when the first was. I know there was some ASM stuff going on, but honestly I didn't write down what it was and I don't remember. I think it was some electoral stuff maybe. Oh, and actually one other big thing, aside from stuff like drafting some training materials for lobbying and what have you for CAPE, one big thing that spring was that I served on the search and screen committee for the provost. So, you know, we basically did what I described before for the chancellor, but for the provost candidates. And the candidate that ended up getting the job was Paul DeLuca. So that was that spring. So that took quite a bit of time. And I learned quite a bit through that process that, again, kind of like the AFT convention about how some of that stuff works and what to do and not to do. But a lot of that I can't really talk about publicly because you're sworn to a veil of secrecy about some of the in the details of such things. So anyway, and then summer, there was another big chunk of time that was taken up by, so for a number of years, the TA and I think also MGAA, the graduate union in Milwaukee, but certainly the TA, we've been kind of trying to figure out ways to get collective bargaining rights extended to RAs because they had not historically had them here. They had them in some other states. But here, the argument was, well, RAs are actually students primarily. This is part of their education. They're not actually employees. But then you'd have these problems with working conditions where you'd have RAs that were required to work very long hours or were not treated fairly or whatever. You know, most of them are treated fairly, but there's some exceptions, right? And so we had been trying to figure out how to, you know, extend collective bargaining rights to RAs as well. And obviously that would also help increase the bargaining strength of the TAA as well if they were to be, you know, part of the TAA. Anyway, so a number of years we've been kind of tossing this around and trying to figure out a way into this, but then suddenly in summer we got word that there was language being added to the budget to do a unit clarification for the TA, which basically means that you redraw the lines around who is actually in the bargaining unit to include RAs. But the problem was, while on the one hand that could be a positive thing, I mean, obviously, the problem was that as far as we could tell, nobody had actually asked any of the RAs or had any sort of consultative process around this. And you don't want to just suck people into your union without them wanting to be in there because that's not democratic and it's not fair. And personally, I don't think it's the right way to go. So, like, I mean, they need to have a choice and there needs to be that sort of participatory involvement and a proactive, like, yes, we want to be part of a union and do this. And it also brought up a number of other potential issues, like legal issues and tax issues that we didn't immediately know the answer to. And so anyway, so basically CAPE ended up getting into this for various reasons. And I think the way this thing got in there was that one of our TA members, Peter Rickman, who I think you interviewed before, was working for Mark Pocan at the time. And I think he got that added, I think with certainly good intentions, but not in, I'm not sure exactly how that happened. But by the time it came out, it was all, I mean, I think that basically the chancellor's office and we all found out about it roughly at the same time, and we all kind of went, whoa! And so there was a lot of email back and forth and a lot of meetings and trying to figure out whether this would cause RAs to suddenly have to pay additional payroll taxes and whether it would threaten certain, I forget all the details, but there was a lot of kind of details of things that apparently hadn't really been looked at that we wanted to make sure that we weren't going to hurt RAs by doing this. And also there's this question of a proactive democratic process. And so we pushed, and successfully, although I can't say it was just necessarily us, because I know the chancellor's office, I think, was pushing for this too, but pushed to change it from a unit clarification to the creation of a new bargaining unit. So that means that you basically, I mean, once there were still those other issues that we were trying to resolve, but this would basically say, okay, RAs can have, you're eligible to bargain collectively if you guys want to. And the final language that ended up in there, and I think Rickman was also involved in the changes, I believe, although I'm not there. I mean, I forget the details of, I think Senator Risser maybe, you know, I don't remember, but anyway, so in the end of the, you know, all of this, which was just some of the, at least up until that time, the most. So there was this one email thread I remember in particular that on the keep our keep list that I think the Gmail, at least at the time, after you got to 100 messages, it would start a new thread automatically. And there was somebody, I can't remember if it was maybe even Joe Salmons or somebody, it might have been one of the people you've interviewed. Well, somebody anyway, I remember commenting that, oh, I was kind of offline for a day and then I came back, I looked at my email and oh my, like, there's this explosion of just this back and forth and back and forth and trying to figure this out. And anyway, the final language ended up being that RAs a new bargaining unit, or technically three, one for UW-Madison, one for UW-Milwaukee, and one for the rest of the system. Three new bargaining units were created for RAs, and they could either, either have card check or or some cards collected in an election to decide whether they wanted to actually form a union. And they could certainly then also opt to join the TA. So if the TA was like collecting cards, that would, they would be on the way to perhaps representing the RAs. So we started, after that ended up passing in that form, started working on trying to, reach out more to RAs. And there was definitely back and forth with RAs at the time as they started to learn about it during this whole explosion of emails phase, where people were hearing about it and concerned and like, well, what does this mean? And I never heard about this, and why? And so we were kind of trying to, get as much information to as many people as possible and figure out a solution that would be the best for everybody, and try to make sure that we weren't going to end up with a situation where RAs were suddenly in a bad position or punished financially for this thing that they shouldn't be, which didn't end up being an issue, but it was this, it was just a very intense, I forget if it was a few weeks or how long this was going on, but I remember it was this big thing that was kind of eating up all of our time for like a while. Mm-hmm. And then finally in the fall of 2009, so I was still on PEC, obviously, on an ongoing basis. I think around that time also, that's when the grad school restructuring business happened, where Biddy Martin wanted to change the structure of the grad school and take the research enterprise out from under the grad school and put it under the chancellor's office, which would basically take it out of the shared governance sort of purview, like faculty in particular have shared governance powers within the grad school, but if it's under the chancellor's office, then not so much. And there was all this back and forth about that. And I have somewhat vague recollections. I remember a lot of discussion and some, I think, town hall meetings and that kind of thing. But I don't know that I did a lot of actual organizing on that, to my recollection, but I was definitely kind of involved in the conversation and in some of the, figuring out, like, I don't know, like I had a friend who had a blog that we'd talk about this and what might be reasonable to post and that kind of thing. But I don't think that, I wasn't like leading a campaign at that point, but I was definitely, I remember that as another thing that was sort of a big deal at the time. And where some people, I think also, that had, some of us who had supported Biddy Martin initially were starting to have some doubts at that point because of the way this thing was kind of came up, where it wasn't a very transparent process. It was just kind of surprise. Here's this big thing we want to change. And it seemed to have some personal, possibly, like, I don't know for sure, but I remember thinking that part of the motivation seemed to be to perhaps get rid of the grad school, the dean of the grad school at the time, or Martin Cadwallader. Mm-hmm. So I don't know exactly, because I don't remember all the details, but I do remember that it was not the prettiest thing, and that it was divisive, and that it seemed to be a bit of a power grab on the chancellor's part. And because Biddy Martin was just, I mean, she's got some social, like, she's just charming. She has got amazing interpersonal skills. She makes you feel so important when you're in front of her, and she feels very sympathetic and all. She's just got very high emotional intelligence, and so it's really easy to like her, personally. And even when I would be mad at her, in a way, I would still like her when I talked to her. I'd still be like, oh, she's really likable. But that's something, I think that was one lesson that I learned through some of this. I mean, you learn different lessons, like you were saying before, is that being charming and having good social skills and all of that is not, I mean, that's something that can be really good if somebody's trying to do things that you think are good, but it's not a good thing at all if it's somebody that's actually trying to do things you don't like, because that just makes them more effective. So so I think I definitely learned some lessons there, because I had certainly, I don't think I probably was played any kind of a decisive role in terms of Biddy Martin being chosen. That email that I drafted mostly and that Mark and I sent, I don't think probably was the deciding factor, although you never know, but I kind of doubt it, certainly. But I mean, I certainly was advocating at that point for, like, this is the candidate that just seems to get it and seems to be the best one. And honestly, in retrospect, I'm not so sure that was Rebecca Blankwood a better option at the time. But, the benefit of hindsight and all that. So, anyway, that's pretty much the end of 2009, so.
Okay. And we are at an hour, so I think this is a good place to wrap up. We won't meet again until September, and in September I'll sort of remind you of where we left off, but we're basically going to probably start with 2010 and then make our way into the protests.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So this concludes the second interview with Kaya Rebina. Thank you for your time.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.